Bitler, February 3rd, 2002, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 56, Ejection and Persecution. Okay, last week we covered how Charles resolved to impose episcopacy on the Scottish Church, how bishops were selected, consecrated, and restored to Parliament, and how the Parliament passed a number of laws which set the legal basis for a great deal of persecution. And I'd sort of like to have my final summary of this with an excerpt from Robert Bailey's final letter. This is to his cousin, William Spang. So, after discussing various things about his health and asking, his cousin is printing a book, and he asks him to hurry up so that it's not an opus posthumus. Some other general comments and so on. He says, "The public affairs, you know them as well and better than I. Our Kirk, all the English times, had been very faithful to our king, and so instrumental as we could for his restitution. We had lost much blood at Dunbar, Worcester, and elsewhere, and at last our liberty in his cause." He says English times, he's referring to when Cromwell and the English Parliament ruled Scotland. "We did firmly expect at his restitution a comfortable subsistence to ourselves and all our Presbyterian brethren in all the dominions, and believed the king's intention was no other. But by divine permission, other counsels thereafter prevailed and now carry all. When the king was at Breda, it was said he was not averse from establishing the presbytery, nor was the contrary peremptorily resolved till the Saturday at night in the cabin council at Canterbury. At the beginning it went on softly. Calamy, Baxter, Manton, Reynolds were made chaplains, but at once it altered. This did come from our supine negligence and inadvertence. For the Parliament, then consisting of the secluded members, the city, Monk also, and the army were for us. Had we but petitioned for Presbytery of Breda, it had been, as was thought, granted. But fearing what the least delay of the king's coming over might have produced, and trusting fully to the king's goodness, we hastened him over without any provision for our safety. At that time it was that Dr. Sheldon, now Bishop of London, and Dr. Morley did poison Mr. Sharp, our agent whom we trusted, who piece and piece, in so cunning a way, has trepanned us." Anybody know what trepanned is? It's a surgical operation which involves cutting a hole in the skull. "As we have never..." I had to look that up, though, so to be sure what it was. "As we never win so much as to petition either king, parliament, or council, my Lord Hyde is the great minister of state who guided all, and to whom, at his lodging in Worcester House, the king weekly and other uses to resort and keep counsel with him alone some hours. And so with the king, Mr. Sharp became more intimate than any man almost of our nation. It seems he has undertaken to do in our church that which he has now performed easily and is still enacting. He had for cooperators the commissioner, chancellor, and Rose. Lauderdale and Crawford were a while contraire, but seeing the king peremptor, they gave over. His Majesty's letter to us at first, penned by Mr. Sharp, promised to keep up our church government established by law, and to send for Mr. Douglas and others to confer about our affairs. The last Mr. Sharp hindered, for with him alone it pleased His Majesty to confer, and the sense of the first, few of us dreamed till it came out thereafter. We were amazed at the proclamation discharging all petitioning against the episcopal government established by law, as it was in the year 1633, of putting down our synods and presbyteries and sessions, of calling up Mr. Sharp, Mr. Fairfound, and Mr. James Hamilton of Camethon, also Mr. Layton, then at London, to be consecrated by the English bishops, which after some time they were by bishops of London, Worcester, and others with many English guises. Their feast to all the Scots, and many of the English nobility, was great. They stayed there some months longer than was expected, that they might be sufficiently instructed in the English way. When they came down, they were received by a number of noblemen, gentlemen, and the magistrates of Edinburgh magnificently. The commissioner's lady feasted them and the nobility that night, as the chancellor did the morrow after. Mr. Sharp had bought a fair new coach at London, at the sides whereof two lackeys in purple does run. So, okay, that's, he then goes on to other things, mentions that the bishop did come visit the University of Glasgow, where he gave him the finest sack and ale, and some other things, but okay, well, the bishops now began to take control of the presbyteries, which they called precincts, in synods, which they now called the dioceses. And I checked after our discussion last week. Well, I didn't check too far, but it's very clearly that at least James King Hewison uses the word diocese and dioceses. The plural, so. However it's pronounced. Dioceses or something. So. Let's see. In the Dunblane diocese, overseen by Bishop Layton, he made relatively few changes at first. In general, overall, relatively few changes were made in the worship. The Lord's Prayer, Doxology, and Creed were added back into the service. But there was no prayer book, surplices, altars, etc., back in the worship service. So some people claim that it was very, you know, there was very little difference between that and earlier Presbyterian worship. According to J.D. Douglas, who wrote this book called Light in the North, which is another history of the Covenanters, says it was the discipline and outward government of the new model church which stuck in Scottish throats. The Covenanters complained, not without reason, that a greater authority was now given to the bishops than their predecessors had enjoyed, and that it was an authority much more harshly exercised. Wadra tried to show the great difference in extent of power assigned to the bishops on the revival of the order by describing those of 1612 as pygmies to the present high and mighty lords. So, Archbishop Sharp was not either so tactful nor so successful as Bishop Layton. A number of the ministers in his diocese refused to come meet with him, and their names were turned over to the Privy Council. He installed constant moderators in the presbyteries that were under his jurisdiction. Yes?
Did he survive the poisoning? He was the guy who was poisoned, Sharp.
He was poisoned in his mind.
Oh.
Not literally poison.
Okay.
Yeah. 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 Sorry. And you could say he survived for a while, but then he succumbed later. So. Okay. So Sharp installed constant moderators. Okay, and this constant moderators was a tact that James had used with the church when he was trying to convert it from Presbyterianism to Episcopacy, right? Typically, a presbytery would have a moderator elected at each meeting of the presbytery, a way to sort of introduce bishops is to change, you know, is to say, well, we're not going to elect the moderator anymore. I'll appoint the moderator, and otherwise, it's the same. But you know, you just sort of keep. Ratcheting up the changes, and moderator, of course, if it's constant, appointed by the bishop, you know, owes his authority somewhere else than the Presbyterian moderator would. In the Diocese of Aberdeen, Bishop Mitchell had only a few recalcitrant ministers. This was where Samuel Rutherford had been exiled to. That area of the country had always leaned towards episcopacy. He solved that problem by deposing one and suspending the other, and that was, I guess, the end of his problems. Okay, well, right about here is when the persecution began. It began first with the ministers. And to put some things in perspective, I think James King Hewison, his sort of a paragraph that covers the beginning of the persecution. I think it's important to put things in perspective, because as time goes on, or as our history goes on, it'll become dominated much less by ideas decisions made at general assemblies and the like, as it has before, and more dominated by anecdotes. So let's see. Scotia sub cruce, Scotland under the cross, was the suggestive title which Robert Wadra, the historian, selected for his manuscript, which he published with the title The History of the Sufferings of the Church of Scotland from the Restoration to the Revolution. A persistent persecution of the Covenanters for 28 years began. As soon as the Privy Council obtained legal authority, means to exercise a spirit which showed itself to be most vindictive, because it was fed on the memories of the hardships borne by the loyal followers of Charles. The need of the gentry, not their love of the Carolin policy, accounts for the excesses into which they fell in expunging nonconformity in order to enrich themselves and their minions with the possessions of their opponents. The hierarchy became a cabal of procurers and panders, not always cloaked in holy vestments. Where the carcass was, there were the vultures also. The air was full of visions of forfeitures, fares for favorites, imposts for squanderers, offices for idlers, and benefices for the disciples of Simon Magus. So, whatever the motivations of the people doing the persecuting were, and I think it's pretty clear they varied quite a bit. At least, you know, one of them was just merely greed. They hoped to get money from fines and forfeitures. Okay, well, let's see. A number of ministers were evicted. We mentioned last week 329 is the estimate of the total number evicted from office. I was reading some more this week claiming there were authoritative evidence for at least 400 evicted. One example is Donald Cargill, who was a minister in Glasgow. Hewison writes that Cargill was so ardent a Presbyterian that on Restoration Day, he prophetically declared that the return of the king was the woefulest sight that ever the poor Church of Scotland saw. Woe, woe, woe to him. His name shall stink while the world stands for treachery, tyranny, and lechery. Heroic, fiery, affectionate, clever, eloquent, of swift foot and tough constitution, Cargill was the leader best fitted to become the ubiquitous apostle of religious rebellion. His happy essays at judgment brought him the credit of having second sight. His marvelous escapes gave him, like Peyton, the character of one who could assume the coat of darkness. This was not the type of man to seek episcopal benediction. For this and other alleged irregularities, the council, when in Glasgow, ordered him to transport himself and his household, be north of Tay before the 1st of November. All right, the River Tay passes through Perth and Dundee. Even today, when you cross the Tay River, you're really getting into pretty remote, unpopulated country. I mean, it's pretty much sort of, when you cross that, you're in the Highlands. Let's see. He had to transport himself and his household. His household contained four or five children of his wife, who was the Lady Plebo. She'd been widowed and then married Cargill and had then died herself only a few months after their marriage. So he had a whole household and a lot of debt due to a strained family situation. In the Presbytery of Dumfries, only two of the ministers conformed to episcopacy, and the other 19 refused. And two of the ministers evicted were John Blackadder of Troquhere and John Welsh of Irongray. Let's see. Blackadder occupied his pulpit. This is from James King Hewison. Blackadder occupied his pulpit till the last Sabbath of October, and on that occasion enlarged on the sin of intruding hireling curates on Christ's flock, and of compliance with the order of eviction. The auditors were in tears. An alarm was raised that the horse guards were approaching to seize him. He retired, but returned to advise his friends to disperse quietly. Leaving his wife and young family in the manse, he sought shelter in the house of William Ferguson of Catelock in Glencairn, a staunch Covenanter. Next Sabbath morning, thinking to catch Blackadder, Turner and the guardsmen revisited the manse. The scene left an ineffaceable impression on one of the minister's sons. The guards in the yard, cursing and blaspheming, the children hidden in the loft, this boy peering through a chink to view the roaring scene, a murdering ruffian below detects the tiny face, draws thrust, and just by scarce an inch misses the chink and glittering eye. The manse was emptied, the little ones packed in cadger's creels, and as the evicted family made for Glencairn, one of the children cried through the brigand, I'm banished. Bite the sheep has banished me. Bite the sheep is what they called this guy Turner, who we'll get to in a little bit. Blackadder and his flight appears to have witnessed the eviction of Welsh. This John Welsh was the son of Josias Welsh, minister in Templepatrick, grandson of John Welsh of Ayr, and great-grandson of John Knox. He was by heredity a reformer and of the stuff saints and martyrs are made of. In his sermons, he had not minced words and styled the estates a drunken parliament. Such freedom of expression was not to be tolerated. The steward deputy, Maxwell of Munches, a papist, was ordered to bring his parish minister into Edinburgh. With some discretion, he permitted Welsh to fulfill his duties of communion at Holywood, an adjoining parish, on a sacrament Monday. The crowds of dalesmen and women who had accompanied him home would have defended him if necessary, had he not wished to go peaceably with his guards. An extraordinary scene occurred on the green banks of the Clewdon, where he was to take horse. The other ministers gathered round him, knelt and prayed. The excited people groaned and cried. They held him there. He had to dash across the ford, only to be chased by the crowd of wailing men and women who followed the cavalcade a long way. After comparing before the Committee of Parliament, he was put under surveillance and was ultimately dismissed in June of 1663. Okay, and there are loads of stories like this about ministers being evicted and so on. In addition to ministers, at least one university professor, David Dixon, who is perhaps best known today for having authored Commentary on the Psalms. It's in the Banner of Truth series. If you go to the carols, it'll be sitting on a shelf somewhere. Well, probably, if it's not in a box. But it's out of the box. Okay. He was an octogenarian. That's, I think, what he said. He said he was very elderly. He was evicted from his office. In May of 1662, Parliament summoned 11 ministers from the west of Scotland and ordered them to sign the Oath of Allegiance. Okay, this Oath of Allegiance is the one that said that you recognize the king's authority over all, in all things, so including ecclesiastical. They ordered them to sign this Oath of Allegiance. They were willing to do so with the explanation that the king's authority didn't extend to things spiritual. So if they could put a little coda on it, that they would sign it. For that, 10 of the 11 were tossed in prison until the 16th of September, where they were released, and then they were deposed from ministry and evicted from their manses. At least one well-known minister, John Carstairs, had his health broken in the prison. I mean, you got to remember, these prisons, this wasn't Guantanamo, after all. It was, nothing that nice. It was even worse than Dartmoor Prison, I think. At the end of 1662, a number of ministers, 14 by my count, and some other men, I'm guessing they were elders, but the Lord didn't say, were summoned to Edinburgh for examination by the Privy Council. John Livingston, a minister at Ancrum, which is near Jedburgh, he was a protester. In fact, he was one of the protesters who had been sent to London to treat with Cromwell, was called up. And he wrote a diary, which, it's called John Livingston's Diary. It's published by the Wigtown District Museum Service in Scotland. You might think it was more as an autobiography because it was written a few years later. He describes the events leading up to this in his exchange with the council. Okay. And whereas a lot of things I read from, like, the Bailey letters, they have F's for S's and various other strange spellings like Y-O-W. This one, they thought it would be quaint to include his rather bizarre shorthand, so if I stumble a little bit, just bear with me. In the year 1662, after that, the Parliament and Council had by proclamation ordered all ministers who'd come in since 1649 and had not kept their holy days of the 29th of May either to acknowledge the prelates or to remove. I might well foresee a storm was coming. At the last communion we had at Ancrum on the 12th of October, and which was more frequent than any before, after sermon on the Monday, it pleased the Lord, I got my mouth opened in a reasonable long discourse, anent the grounds and encouragements to suffering for the present controversies of the kingdom of Christ, in appointing the government of his own house, and in a manner took my leave, although I knew nothing what was then in hand and followed shortly thereafter. But on the 20th of November, I got letters from some friends in Edinburgh that on the 18th of that month, the council had ordered some 12 or 16 ministers to be brought before them. Where I was one, I went presently to Edinburgh and keep myself close for some days till I should in a private way search and get some notice what they were minded to do. For if they should only proceed to banishment, as they had the year before done to Mr. McWard and Mr. Simpson, I was resolved to appear, although the citation had not come to me. But if I found they were on such a design as against Mr. Guthrie, that my life were in danger and I was minded to lurk, I was minded to lurk and not appear, seeing I was not cited nor apprehended. But finding their sentence would only be banishment, and Mr. Trail having got that sentence on the 9th of December, I did on the 11th of December, being called before the council, compare. That's an old Scots law term for appear in court. I have another paper subjoined here to set down. Let's see. I have in another paper subjoined here to set down what passed, particularly when I was before the council, the sum of all that came to this. They required me to subscribe the oath, which they call the Oath of Allegiance, wherein the king was to be acknowledged supreme governor over all persons and in all causes, both civil and ecclesiastic. This I knew was conceived in so general, ambiguous, and comprehensive terms that it might import receding from the covenant for reformation and the bringing in of the bishops. In the summer before, when some ministers of the West had given in their sense that they would acknowledge the king, supreme civil governor, even in ecclesiastic matters, that sense was rejected, therefore I refused to take that oath. They desired to know if I would take some time to advise and mend the matter, as some who had been before them had done. This I thought would import that I was not fully clear nor resolved in the matter. It would render both myself open to many temptations and offend and weaken many others. Therefore, I told I needed not take time, seeing that I was abundantly clear that I could not lawfully take that oath. This made them the sharper against me. They pronounced a sentence of banishment that I should in 48 hours depart out of Edinburgh and go to the north side of Tay, and within 2 months depart out of all the king's dominions. He then goes on to tell a story, but while he was there, one of the macers, who I believe is one of the functionaries who carries around the mace, had been someone that had previously disciplined from church, had to remove from the communion table, and the guy got quite enraged with him. So, okay, for the other ministers, two of them did decided to sign this oath of allegiance. The others didn't, and some were banished. At least one was confined to a small village. I'm not sure what happened to every single one of them. Elsewhere, the Privy Council ordered specific ministers who had not yet conformed to remove themselves and their families beyond the bounds of their presbyteries. A few ministers were overlooked, apparently due to having friends in high places. One of these would be William Guthrie of Fenwick. Another minister, Andrew Donaldson in Dalgetty, was interceded for by the Earl of Dunfermline, and the Earl got the king to cancel the minister's summons. However, he was deposed by a synod in October 1664, so he was received a respite, but not any kind of permanent release. Actually, he kept preaching even after he was deposed, his flock remaining staunch to him in spite of heavy finings, and he was Andrew Donaldson was put to the horn in July of 1674, and he was intercommuned 2 years later. He was imprisoned in Linlithgow prison for a year, and he lived on after the Restoration. He finally was reinstated in his church. Okay, and one of the ministers that wasn't overlooked was Alexander Payden. Okay, I mentioned him when I was talking about Donald Cargill. Cargill and Payden are both the ministers that we'll come across again in the future. Payden was sometimes called the prophet of the covenant. If you read the history of the covenanters, you are going to find very sort of strange things, and it's sometimes hard to know what to make of them, but as an example, on his last Sabbath there, he spent like an entire day preaching, and he preached on Acts 20:17-32, told his congregation that they would see him no more because he was to become a homeless vagrant for his master's cause. On the way out the door, he knocked hard upon it three times over, saying, I arrest thee in my master's name, and never none enter thee, but such as come in at the door as I did. And supposedly, no one did fill the pulpit until 1693. Some of the parishioners fought back. There was when a minister accompanied by an armed bodyguard was intruded on the Iron Gray Church, which is formerly the one that John Welsh ministered in. A crowd of women, generaled by Margaret Smith, occupied the walled-in churchyard, a natural coign of vantage, and after a hot skirmish of stones easily got from the Cluden, made the proletic intruders beat a hasty retreat. Okay. Another such riot, which preventing a prelate from taking the pulpit that occurred early in 1663 in Kirkcudbright, sparked a major shift in government policy. Up until now, most of the actions have been taken against the ministers, and they had, whether they were deposed or thrown in prison or whatever, they went, you know, they pretty much went along with their sentence at some, you know, at some level. But now the persecution was to be brought in and brought home to the parishioners. The Privy Council met in May of 1663. They appointed a commission to go to the southwest of Scotland. And again, this has been the sort of the staunchest covenanting part of Scotland. And they were to bring the offenders to justice and to inquire if all the officials had obeyed the recent statutes. A detachment of soldiers, 100 on horse and 200 on foot, were ordered to accompany the commission, and, quote, to exact for themselves free quarters and generous pay for officers and men. It might take just a minute to let that sink in. I think most of us think of quartering of soldiers. I think probably the first thing that comes to mind is that there's this Third Amendment to the United States Constitution that says that, you know, we won't quarter. Our soldiers can't be quartered without proper pay and so on. So it might seem to us like an abstract concept, but in practice, right, you'd have a bunch of rude, uncouth, obnoxious soldiers that you had to put up, and they would, while they were there, they would help themselves to your goods and your livestock and kill your calves and, you know, so on. You know, so on. This was actually quite serious way of persecuting people. For that matter, sometime later in the class, you might look up the U.S. Constitution, go read the Bill of Rights, and you'll see that almost every amendment in the Bill of Rights reads as if it might have been written thinking of this period. And in one sense, it probably was, not just this period, but other sort of British outrages that in the 17th and early, you know, or early to mid 18th century. Right. So, you know, almost everyone, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, the right to keep and bear arms, you just go on and on, you'll see that all these things were the things that the British government was routinely violating. Is anachronistic, but they were all impinging on the people's liberties. As for the generous pay that they were to obtain, it was, we'll see later, it was squeezed out of the people through fines and other forms of thievery. Fines for not attending church and fines on relatively little evidence that you were presumed guilty. The commission of the Privy Council first met in Kirkcudbright on the 25th of May. They decided that the three local magistrates were all privy to the riot. So they and five of the women were arrested and taken to Edinburgh for trial. Another 14 women were put in the local bridewell, or jail, until they could provide caution, which is money to ensure their good behavior, or in this case it was money to, it was basically like a bail to ensure that they would appear later before the Privy Council. Some men, or I'm not sure how many, but a number of them went to jail in lieu of their wives. On the 30th of May, 1663, they met in Dumfries to investigate the rock-throwing uprising at Iron Gray that I told you about. They sent one William Arnaud to Edinburgh for trial, and, quote, as a penalty for undiscovered culprits, they quartered soldiery on the parish and exacted a bond of £100 from the heritors. Okay, the heritors were the local landowners. So again, I
I guess in theory they could eventually get the bond back. I don't know if they did, but okay, at the trial in August, one of the local magistrates from Kirkaby was banished. Another was fined 8,000 merks. And no, I don't know what a merk is in a modern American currency, so it just sounds like a lot of money. We'll leave it at that. And William Arnault was fined 5,000 merks. The five women from Kirkaby were ordered home to stand for 2 market days at the cross of Kirkaby with a placard on each face announcing the crime, and the magistrates were empowered to scourge and banish the criminals if they tried to evade this doom. The men who had taken the place of their wives in jail were released after spending 16 weeks in jail and providing a monetary caution. Okay, in September of 1663, Sir James Turner was sent to the southwest of Scotland to settle affairs. Turner was a former mercenary. He had returned from Germany to fight in the English Civil War. He ended up fighting on the parliamentary side, even though he originally intended to fight on the king's side. By his own account, he wrote memoirs later, and so this is a quote from them. He had swallowed without chewing in Germany a very dangerous maxim, which military men there too much follow, which was that so we serve our masters honestly, it is no matter which master we serve, so without examination of the justice of the quarrel or regard of my duty to either prince or country, I resolved to go with that ship I first encountered. If I remember right, he actually first encountered a ship that would have taken him to where he could join the royalist army, but the ship wouldn't wait for his baggage to arrive, so he then had to take the next ship, which took him to fight for the parliament. He didn't care as long as he got paid. I think I may have quoted this before. One writer said there was this ironic thing about all these Scottish mercenaries that for them having a civil war in their home country was a good opportunity to go home and get paid, you know, visit the homelands. Okay, later he fought to put down the Irish Rebellion and then served under Leslie, cleaning up the remnants of Montrose's forces. So again, that was on the Covenanter side, but he convinced himself it was okay because the people that he was cleaning up actually deserted the king. So. Later, he worked for the Engager government, okay, and here he got his first experience in persecuting civilians. He was sent to Glasgow to put down opposition to the engagement. And again, quoting him, I found my work not very difficult, for I shortly learned to know that the quartering of 2 or 3 troopers and half a dozen musketeers was an argument strong enough in 2 or 3 nights' time to make the hardest-headed Covenanters in the town to forsake the Kirk. Okay, now I think he doth exaggerate, but he'd done this, quartering on the populace before. He was captured at the Battle of Preston Moor. He was imprisoned at Hull, and then he made his way to the continent. He returned to Scotland when the Act of Classes was relaxed. He admits to faking his repentance, though the ministers knew well enough that they were but counterfeit. Actually, let me just get this and read this. This is... Yeah, this is just a paragraph. Behold a fearful sin. The ministry of the gospel received all our repentances as unfeigned, though they knew well enough they were but counterfeit. And we, on the other hand, made no scruple to declare that engagement to be unlawful and sinful, deceitfully speaking against the dictates of our own consciences and judgments. If this is not mocking the all-seeing and all-knowing God to his face, then I declare myself not to know what a fearful sin hypocrisy is. And then Stevenson says, the burden does not seem to have weighed too heavily on him, however. Okay, so that goes back to the protesters and resolutioners. The resolutioners are the one that wanted to let all these guys like Sir James Turner back into the army, you know, if he would just repent, you know, and he said, we repented, they knew it was, you know, counterfeit, but... Let's see. So he was then fighting for the king. Then he was captured at the Battle of Worcester, but escaped and went back to the continent again. When Charles regained the throne, Turner returned to Britain, was knighted, and he received a commission as sergeant major of the king's foot guards. And here was a man, with the ideal resume to be a persecutor of the Covenanters. You know, he had lots of military experience, had experience persecuting Covenanters, and so on. And later he actually gets...
he gets fired from his job and was told that, you know, under the pretext that he had been too harsh, etc. But he claims that why the persecution wasn't successful is because it wasn't hot enough. So, okay, as I mentioned last time, the Earl of Middleton got himself fired for his self-serving representation of the king, with the last or next to the last straw being the Billeting Act. He was appointed governor of Tangiers, where I think in 1674 he fell to his death from a balcony while drunk. So, and one other factoid of interest, and every now and then I find something like this, you know, even though it's maybe not directly germane, you have to hear. Lauderdale was complaining that he was so busy. He says, "No dog leads so busy a life. I am perfectly dazed." No wonder. And then James Houston King goes on to mention all the things that Lauderdale was working on at the start of this new parliament. He had to inquire into Middleton's peculation or embezzlement of £30,000 of army pay, and the fraud of Middleton's vicereign, his wife, who imagined that the furniture in Holyrood was her own. So, if that sounds familiar, from somebody who imagined that the furniture in the White House was their own, well, here's a precedent. The king appointed John Leslie, the Earl and Duke of Ross, a coarse, illiterate boor, salacious in talk and indecent in behavior, as his new commissioner to the Scottish Parliament. According to Hewison, his greed of gain made him a tool most amenable to be a persecutor. His carnal characteristics distinguished him as the type of man the king loved. He roguishly excused his own uncleanness of life by asserting that the king's commissioner ought to represent his person.
Okay, at the start of the Third Scottish Parliament on the 18th of June, 1663, or the Third Post-Restoration Parliament, Rose informed the Parliament that the king wished to restore the Lords of the Articles. And some of you may recall that this was a small committee that formulated all of the legislation for the Parliament to vote up or down. Basically, it eliminated parliamentary debate. It was a way for the king to pretty much control the Parliament, because he controlled who would be on the Lords, who would be the Lords of the Articles, and they would write all the legislation. On the 8th of July, 1663, Sir Archibald Johnston of Worston, again, who had been co-author of the National Covenant, clerk of the General Assembly in 1638, and a representative of the Westminster Assembly and a staunch protester, was brought before the Parliament, read the sentence that had been passed in absentia in 1661. He'd been discovered in France and extradited to England, then sent by ship to Edinburgh, and according to John Brown of Wamphray, an exiled Scottish minister, Worston was poisoned by an English royal physician. According to John Brown, that left him somewhat out of his mind. Whatever the reason, when Worston appeared back before Parliament, he was quite distraught and so on. And let's see, Gilbert Burnett describes this. This mentions that Worston had lived formerly in great friendship with the Earl of Lauderdale. Worston and Lauderdale were both lay members of the Westminster Assembly. Okay, but Lauderdale at this critical juncture would not interpose in his favor, although he, Worston, was so disordered both in body and mind that it was really a reproach to the government to proceed against him. His memory was so far gone that he did not know his own children, and when he was brought before the Parliament to show cause why his execution should not be awarded, his words were disordered, and his deportment unequal, as might be expected from a man in his condition. When he came to die, however, he showed more composedness and serenity. This was two weeks after July 8th. And in a long speech, which he read twice on the scaffold, justified all the proceedings of the covenant and asserted his own sincerity. But he condemned his joining with Cromwell and the sectaries, although even in that his designs, he said, had been upright for the good of his country and the security of religion. Okay, so Royston was executed there were 2 weeks later, 22nd, I think, of July. And sort of a final wrap up on Worston. James King Hewison says he was eminent Scot who, despite the defects of his impetuous nature and border blood, was one of the most sincere and devout upholders of the Reformed faith in its covenanted form.
A pious lawyer, a rare phenomenon in his day, I'm sure not to mention her own, a conscientious politician, an equally rare subject, he had doubts about complying with the sectaries, and a pure-minded man, worse than possessed so many other worldly characteristics that his son-in-law, Jervis Wood, best described him as a man with God. So, worse than kept a diary that was, I think, some of it was lost, but there are three volumes extant, and Stevenson has a biography of him in this book, King or Covenant, and he was sometimes Stevenson casts him in a rather strange light, and sometimes I think you could see why if you read some of the things that he said. They certainly seem strange to modern ears, but he was a really staunch defender, not a clergyman, but a lay defender of the covenanted Reformation. So, okay, I think we better stop there. And are there any questions or comments? Or Bruce?
If we can back up.
I love to back up. I mean, that's why I cross stock and trade. Let's go back.
What was the motivation why the Episcopal Church was wanting to reassert? I mean, was there a rebellion amongst the Presbyterians, or are they just starting to get greedy for all the power? Or what were the events?
Well, I mean, it's all, this has been going on at this point nearly 60 some years. Basically, one of his maxims was no bishop, no king. And he asserted that if you couldn't control the church by appointing bishops, that you couldn't control the country. And so it's not so much the Episcopal, I mean, there were certainly, of course, ministers and so on who were enthusiasts for Episcopal government, but it was even had a greater draw among the king and his followers, because it was a way for them to control the church.
Sort of the reasserting of the need to have that kind of control was there. Did the king feel like certain things were out of control?
Well, his father was executed by, not by the Presbyterians, actually. The Presbyterians didn't want to execute him, but by non-conformists, people who wouldn't conform to the Episcopal Church in England. Okay. Now, there were, a variety of, there were, I guess, probably hundreds of sects and so on at that time. So they went all the way from things that, including Presbyterians, he would think of Presbyterians, but other ones included people that were probably very solid, solidly reformed, if not Presbyterian in their former church government, solid reformed independents, all the way to wild Arminians and Quakers and every other kind of thing under the sun. So yeah, he would say that lack, basically things got completely out of control because of this because I guess you could say nonconformity, people leaving the established church. So, yeah, I think that's, it's basically a way of reasserting control.
How long is this control going to be going on for?
Well, one sense to 1688 when, Charles II will die and then his brother James II will take over, and James II will be thrown out of office. And then at the sometimes called the Glorious Revolution, William and Mary come over, and at that time all the persecution is relaxed, and actually a Presbyterian church gets set up in Scotland again. But, so, although some of the Covenanters stayed out of the post-revolution church because it was still, in one sense, Erastian. It was still set up by the king. So, and that's the sort of strain that we come from, but that's getting pretty far ahead in our story. So, other questions? No, go ahead.
This is just more light commentary on the advantages of our enlightened age. because those guys could have signed that oath, and all he would have had to have said was, all depends on what you mean by the word all.
Yeah. I'm sure some of them mean Lauderdale. We're not, we may be enlightened, but there were people there who were plenty enlightened. Lauderdale being one of them said he would sign a cartload of oaths. So. Mr. Edmondson? Well, just wait till next week. they did establish a militia. It was pretty ad hoc, so it wasn't very successful. But anyways, okay, well, why don't we stop there and...